Hi, this is Asteroids in Exile. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 5.
Hello.
We've got a lot to talk about today. How are you doing, Martin?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. It's a glorious Sunday morning in Chicago. The weather is finally warm. It was 30 degrees Celsius yesterday. It was fantastic. Really enjoyed it.
The same here. So.
Really, oh, really? Oh, nice.
The sweat Everyone's good. Running down my back. Because I forgot to put on short trousers today. So I went out with jeans. And it was lovely.
It's lovely being hot for a change. Yeah. I mean, it was great. Yesterday we went out to just around the Michigan Avenue and Millennium Park area, and there was people everywhere. I mean, tourists and I'm assuming a whole bunch of locals as well, because it was pretty busy. And the Blues Fest was going on in Millennium Park as well. And after like 9 months of winter and bad weather, people just loved coming out. Like everyone was just so excited and so happy to be out there. It was great.
Yeah, it's the same here today when I walked home from work. A lot of children out there with the scooters just soaking in sunlight. It was a great sight to behold.
Yeah, it's like finally, it's like, you know, at the end of those movies where like the it's all dark and gray and then the clouds burst open and everyone just walks out into the sunlight. That's kind of what it feels like.
Yeah, like the end of Batman versus Superman when the doors open after the credits and you can leave the venue.
Yes.
Best moment.
It's like, yes, I get to return out of this darkness.
I got the shitting on Batman versus Superman.
Well, that was done, and we're only like 3 minutes in, so, you know, good work. We're going to move along very quickly today. We are going to start with some sad news, though, today, because we had some unfortunate news over the last week. So we had two major announcements. So Roger Moore and Adam West both passed away, which was a bit of a shock and sad news to hear during the week. So Roger Moore was my James Bond. You know, it's the James Bond that I grew up with. The James Bond that kind of went a bit crazy as well. Like, he was the James Bond with a lot of the crazy tech. He had the, I think there was once where he skied off a cliff in, I'm not sure if it was the Alps, but he skied off a cliff and his parachute was the Union Jack, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's just so over the top. Like, you know, that's the one thing I remember about the Roger Moore James Bond. When you're trying to be a covert undercover secret agent, what you want is your parachute to have the Union Jack on it, you know, emblazoned and massive Union Jack on the flag.
Yeah, he was in all of the movies. I think it was the one with Christopher Walken and Grace Jones, where I think it's a police officer. Oh, you're James Bond.
Yeah.
Secret agent.
Yeah. So Roger Moore will obviously be missed. And the same with Adam West. So he was the quintessential Batman of the 60s.
Yeah.
The one that effectively we still talk about left a massive impression in the culture. And especially like how Batman was seen for a very long time, right?
And also he was the guy that got me into comic books and pop culture. He was my first Batman, because up until then I only knew artwork from a book about comics that my mother owned. So I had I only know some Jim Aparo and Neil Adams drawings of Batman.
Right. I didn't realize that, yeah.
It really hit me yesterday when I read that.
Yeah, it was a bit of a shock. I remember, you know, I knew Batman just in the background. And the first time I saw the Adam West stuff, it was like, what is this? Because I always saw Batman as a dark, menacing figure, right?
Okay.
And being able to see the Adam West version was so much of fun. It took me a while to adjust, but it showed like how versatile the character can be and why it's been so enduring for so long. And you know, I don't think you can ever have anything like that now. Like, it would now, because of Christopher Nolan, because of the trajectory that the character's taken, even with Batfleck, the Ben Affleck Batman now, you know, Batman's becoming darker and darker and more brooding and, you know, psychologically disturbed as we go forward. Whereas the Adam West Batman was just pure fun, you know? And yeah, so it is a great loss for sure.
And not even fun, it would be, that's the Batman that we will have in a perfect world.
World now.
Yeah, if the biggest problem were some obscure treasury burglary crimes. And not
the
hate.
Crimes were much simpler as well, weren't they? I mean, the Joker did have like all those crazy bombs and stuff.
Yeah, you know, nobody.
And you could just solve everything with anti-shock repellent.
and the safety of the civilians were insured.
Yeah,
or to a large degree.
And that's a great point. I mean, it does reflect kind of just you know, a simpler time.
Yeah.
You know, when super villainy was a crazy guy dressed up as a clown, you know, and even then, not a psychotic clown, just a clown. He was just running around doing clownish circusy things. You know,
even the Riddler out-jokered the Joker, because Frank Gorshin's Riddler, I think, if you've put him in makeup, would have made the perfect Joker.
Really? Well, now, you mean like in hindsight?
In hindsight, yeah.
That's how we've defined the Joker now, is we've taken some of those elements.
Cesar Romero did. Is my Joker as well, because, you know, first exposure to Batman, but I liked Frank Gorshin as the Riddler more than the Joker.
Right. I can't remember the Riddler from the 60s Batman. I have to go back, because the Joker is the one that stands out. Like, well, yeah. Whenever they replay clips, it's always a Joker clip, you know.
Well, yeah, they have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but and you've also got to know here that Adam West was considered for the role of Bond. Is that true?
Yeah. And they chose Roger Moore over Adam West. I want to go in a parallel dimension where Adam West played James Bond and Roger Moore played Batman.
See, you know, and it's weird. And I think for that same reason, I can't see that. Like, I don't know if Roger Moore could play as a wacky Batman as Adam West did. And by the same token, I don't know if Adam West could play a suave English gentleman as James Bond's supposed to be. Yeah. So.
I don't know if perhaps he could. Yeah, yeah, no.
You know, it's just because like I know those two actors in those specific roles, so I can't really see them as other roles, because like even Roger Moore was the Saint, right? So yeah. He was the character the Saint, which was also very much like a James Bond analog.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like being a part of that high society kind of mix and infiltrating and sort of being charismatic and going undercover kind of thing. So whereas Batman's the 60s Batman was a little bit of a different animal, you know.
But then The Persuaders was a much more lighthearted show that he did with Tony Curtis.
This is Roger Moore?
Yeah, yeah. He played an English aristocrat who stumbled into action situations, kind of like Batman to a degree.
Oh, right.
Yeah, but the show's shit.
It was like...
In German, in English, but it's great in German because they were very creative. With dubbing the show.
With the translation?
Yeah.
God, so they did like different voice cast, right?
Different voice cast, and they change dialogue. Oftentimes they just, people
I love it.
Talk about how the stew that's on the menu will rip your pants when you fart. Yeah.
So wait, not only they were like, this show is crap, let's just rewrite the whole script. let's rewrite all the dialogue so we can make it funnier in German.
Yeah, and it's magnificent.
It's almost like making a parody. It's like when you're doing like an alternative voiceover of a clip. It's like effectively that's what they did with the show. That's awesome. All right. Well, unfortunately, I don't speak German, so I don't think I'm going to get that. I'm not going to understand that completely. But that's cool. All right. So yeah. So. Pay our respects to Roger Moore and Adam West. And I think we should spend some time watching a Roger Moore James Bond and a couple of episodes of the 1960s Batman. What's the official title of the 1960s Batman? Was it just the Batman? Was it Batman and Robin? I can't remember now.
I think it was Batman, yeah.
Just Batman, right? Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. Yeah, so put that on your queue for this week.
I've already got a date with my dad to rewatch some Roger Moore Bond movies.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Do you guys have Father's Day coming up in Austria?
I think it's today. My family don't really celebrate such occasions.
Oh, right. Okay.
We love each other every day.
Every day.
And my dad always gets little presents from me, nice. Like updating his virus scanner.
Oh, right. Those little presents? Yeah. I was going to say, you're making me feel bad now, but yeah, I mean, I was just talking to my parents last night, because they're back in Australia, and they were already making the list of tech support I need to do when I get back there, so.
We're great kids.
Yeah. Oh, dear. And yeah, the reason why I asked, I mean, that would have been a great Father's Day to do as well, but like you said, you just do it anytime you need to, so. Because Father's Day in Australia is, I think it's in September, so it's actually in a different date compared to America, and it sounds like Austria as well.
Yeah, Germany has had Father's Day 2 weeks ago.
Oh, right. Okay. I didn't realize. Because Mother's Day is pretty much universal, isn't it? It's the same day everywhere, but Father's Day is all over the place. It's hard to keep track of. Cool. So moving on then to movie news. So what's been going on in the movie industry? Sounds like not a whole lot. It's been a pretty slow week from our point of view. So
yeah, after the last episode, it's like a vacational episode, this one. Mel Brooks said that he's in talks with MGM about producing Spaceballs 2. And I'm not sure how to feel about that, because the first movie was already perfect.
The first movie was perfect. It was it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. I think now, you know, it's probably getting to the point where we need a good parody take on all the superhero crap that's going on, and the same with all the space science fiction stuff. So between Aliens, all the new Star Wars coming out, Jar Jar Binks, I mean, he missed the whole Jar Jar Binks thing. He didn't have to. That's why we didn't have. He's like, look, Star Wars is doing it to itself. I don't need to parody this stuff, right? But with like superheroes, Star Wars and sci-fi, and all of this stuff, like all of this franchise filmmaking that's going on now, I think it's actually a good time to bring something like this up. Because we haven't had one in a while. Like, they've had, like, a teen horror parodies and, like, Hunger Games parodies and things like that. Those are all kind of shit.
Yeah.
You know, and then Leslie Nielsen had, like, the Naked Gun series back in the 90s, was it?
Yeah, the 80s and the 90s, yeah.
And then there was, like, movies like Airplane.
Yeah.
Like, those were all just crazy. We need, I don't know, like, we need something like that now. And I think if they do Spaceballs, even though he's calling it Spaceballs too, if we can get a Mel Brooks take on the current state of the industry and the kinds of movies that are coming out, I think I would love to see that.
Yeah, would be great, because the guy's, I think he's still sharp as ever, despite his old age. But I think, I hope he doesn't star in the movie. And I don't know why that bothers me now, because it's the one thing that puts me off in Spaceballs.
Is that Mel Brooks, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't tell you why. It's always with Braveheart, when somebody does direct a movie and star in it.
You think it's just too much of hubris to be an actor and a director in the same movie?
It's kind of off putting. It works in Braveheart, but I kind of notice it in Spaceballs. I don't know.
Yeah.
But as you said,
look, so Mel Brooks is like, what, he's 90 now?
Yeah.
So I don't know whether he would want to direct and act, or even do either one of those things, or rather than just produce and sort of do the script. But I mean, I don't have anything personally against Mel Brooks, but I think as long as it fits in with what they're trying to do, for me, it's fine.
I think if anybody can make a working parody that's funny and intelligent at the same time, it's Mel Brooks these days.
And it'd be good to get his perspective, because there's so many parodies happening on YouTube, you know? So there's like How It Should Have Ended, and there's a whole bunch of like channels that just do parodies of superhero movies and like what's going on with film now. It'll be good to get sign of like, you know, someone who's from the classic, the old guard of making those parodies, come back and give us their perspective on what they're seeing.
But I wonder if that works today, because at work, when The Naked Gun is on, or we watch Airplane, we watch that movie religiously at work. When we are on breaker duty or something like that. It's at least on once a month.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
And we're always asking ourselves, could something like that work today? Would a big Hollywood studio even be interested in producing something so crazy today?
Yeah.
Yeah, some of the jokes are hit and miss, but it's just the sheer insanity of the situation that makes it so enjoyable.
It is. It is sheer insanity.
Yeah.
And I think we need a little bit more of that in our entertainment, because there's a trend in things getting darker and more serious.
Yeah.
You know, and like, a lot of these movies, I mean, it's good that they do take themselves seriously and they do take the subject matter seriously, but it's good every now and again to inject some craziness into it, just to show people that, you know, it's not the most important thing in the world where you need to like really berate actors and take down movies on Twitter because of their Rotten Tomatoes score. And, you know, people, there's like the fanaticism that we see in politics. And you know, you can say even sports sometimes, maybe sports not so much, I don't know. But we're seeing it with some movies as well. Like, there's a lot of hate being directed to some movies, and there's active campaigns where people are trying to take down movies before they even come out. I don't even understand why. Like, even if it's like a Marvel versus DC thing, it's like, it's not a zero-sum match, you know? It's not about winners and losers.
No, it's about the entertainment. We all should be winners. Or we should be the winners.
Well, that's the thing. It's like we should demand good quality product. We shouldn't be making fun of the fact that DC movies suck. We should be angry about it and saying, DC, you need to do a better job.
Yeah.
You know? And by the same token, the same should be done of Marvel. Like, we shouldn't be complacent and just watch whatever Marvel movie comes out because it's a Marvel movie and like it. It needs to be that it needs to be a quality product. It's just that, you know, some studios have a different approach and a different set of creative teams. But at the end of the day, it's all about, is there story, is there character, and does it actually entertain in a quality way?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, maybe something like doing a Spaceballs 2 would help sort of just get people's reality adjusted.
Perhaps it could work.
Yeah.
We could bring back the classic style of comedy an older style of comedy.
Well, yeah. I mean, in Australian culture, Australian parlance, you know, you need to take the piss every now and again, is what we would have said, just to keep people grounded.
Yep.
You know? So that's why it's good. I mean, at this stage, it's just Mel Brooks talking, right? So
he's
not, they haven't signed anything yet. So I guess we'll just sort of keep an eye on that one and see if anything comes of it. But it's probably something that'll be good to have.
You know how crazy the times are? I've recently rewatched Ant-Man and I thought, shit, we got an Ant-Man movie. Like, it has become the norm that all the crazy things become reality at some point. All the crazy three projects one has had as a kid. Okay. On to the next bit of news, which is again, sad news. Well, for one person, it's sad news. For a whole fandom, it's good news. Joss Whedon is going to complete Justice League because Zack Snyder's family suffered a tragedy.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's an extremely bad and sad situation.
Yeah.
So Zack Snyder had to take a leave because he was pretty much in the last part of the production for Justice League. So they were doing some reshoots and they were effectively at the editing stage, I think, at this stage. Do we want to go into what happened?
I don't know. I guess I'll put a link in the show notes. Let's leave it at that because it's a pretty sad story. And
well, let's just stick to just the film level then. So what ended up happening was that Zack Snyder had to go for a family emergency and Joss Whedon has been brought in to effectively wrap up the production on Justice League. So what that involves, to my understanding, is they are reshooting a couple of scenes because as they go through the editing and they realize that maybe, you know, they could add a bit here and there or sort of redo a bit. So Joss Whedon's looking after that and he's also looking after just the post-production type stuff. So just to sort of bring the movie up. But, you know, I think there's two things that I want to say. So one is like 90%, maybe 90%, 80% of the movie's done at this point. So all of the principal photography, all of the filming's done. And the script is effectively locked in at this stage. Like there's not a whole bunch of major changes that can happen, right? So, and I think Joss Whedon said the same thing. He goes, at this stage, it's really about making it the best version of the movie that was being made.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing. He didn't say that, but it's about, you know, the vision that Zack Snyder had and the vision that the team had when they're putting this together. That's what his job is to do, is to make sure that they can produce the best version of that. And also, there's something else I was going to say, which I now completely forgot. Anyway,
okay.
I can't remember what it is. It'll come back to me.
But while you said the movie's basically done, Justice League was already basically done. Because I think it's in the article I linked to in our internal document, and I'll link to in the show notes as well, that they already did large reshoots when Zack Snyder was still attached, and they basically produced this movie two times already.
Yeah,
and now Joss Whedon is doing some reshoots, and I feel really bad for Zack Snyder because everything that's great in the movie will probably be attributed with Joss Whedon. Well, all the shit parts are going to be...
I'm not so sure, though. I mean, look, there was a schedule of reshoots, and so Joss Whedon didn't introduce new reshoots. He just introduced, like, he just completed the schedule of reshoots that they were going to do.
Oh, okay. I thought that he said, you know, we take this and this out because it doesn't work for him. I thought he would...
No, so and that was what I was thinking about before. So okay. Joss Whedon had actually been brought in like months and months ago, to help consult, because Joss Whedon does like a script doctor type role for a lot of scripts and a lot of movies. So he was brought in a while ago. So he understands, like, he's already in the Warner Brothers family. So we're also going to talk about how he's got the Batgirl movie coming up, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, he's going to be making the Batgirl movie. But he already consulted, so he was familiar with what was going on with Justice League. He was familiar with Zack Snyder and the vision. And he helped consult on the script and a few other things on how to put the movie together. And so now that he's coming in, he's effectively continuing that vision.
Okay, so if he was in the whole production process from that early on a stage,
yeah,
I guess then the,
which is why it makes sense for him to come in,
yeah,
right at this stage, because you wouldn't bring in someone who's completely new to what's going on.
No,
you want
no,
someone
of course
with a bit of the knowledge, so that handover, and especially because it was such a quick, because I mean you think about it the other way as well, it was such a quick changeover,
yeah,
that Joss Whedon wouldn't have had time to even schedule reshoots, because you need to get everybody back and all costuming and everything. Like, you need to sort of set up that whole thing. And that takes a while to organize. So it's interesting. I think it's bad that Zack Snyder had to go. But at the very least, I think Joss Whedon's good hands to leave something like this in to sort of bring the movie across the line.
Yeah. So, couldn't have made a better choice, I think, with the replacement.
Which also means, you know, now that Joss Whedon's jumped... He's jumped houses. He went from the House of the Mouse and the Marvel Studios franchise to now being in the DC family.
Yeah, he's a brother.
So he's a brother.
Brother.
I didn't even pick that. I did not even think of that. That's great. So we'll see how that turns out. Warner Brothers. I think if you look at these movies, does give a lot more leeway to the creative teams who are making these movies.
Yes,
so they don't, you know, I mean, to some extent, maybe they get involved. Maybe there's a lot of studio production notes. But if you look at the movies that are coming out, they seem to be very much the vision of the creators involved. Suicide Squad, who knows what happened there, but at least with Zack Snyder.
he has free reigns.
Yeah. And so it's also cool then, because that was like the biggest complaint that Joss Whedon had about working with Marvel, was that he just, you know, he felt very constrained and he really didn't enjoy working in that environment where he was being told and mandated certain things to do in the movies. So he's now in Warner Brothers and his big project is Batgirl. Batgirl. And what's that? That's like intended to come out in like 2019 or something, I heard.
I just heard that they moved up the schedule. They moved Batgirl and Justice League Dark up the schedule.
Oh, right.
So I think 2019, because Aquaman is 2018. Who knows?
Okay.
At this moment.
Yeah.
But I asked myself, what does this mean for Ben Affleck's Batman movie? Because we haven't heard anything about that. And with War on the Planet of the Apes coming up, I guess Matt Reeves has other troubles at the moment than announcing Batman-related stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the whole, like, so the Batman and I think the Flash as well.
Yeah, the Flash.
Both of those movies have kind of fallen off the cliff right at the moment. We don't really know what's happening with them and what the plan is. So because Ben Affleck dropped out as the director, then they had another guy in, I can't remember who that was, and then that fell apart. And there's all of these rumors. I had a rumor at one point Mel Gibson was slated to be the director, but I think they were in talks, I'm not sure.
For Suicide Squad 2.
Oh, was that for Suicide Squad 2? Okay.
It was been amazing, Mel Gibson, crazy Mel, Rick's doing Suicide Squad.
Yeah, I mean, Mel Gibson's a good director, and you need someone who can really manage the craziness of Suicide Squad in a, you know, and I'm going to use the word serious way, but in a way that actually makes sense and has a story. The first movie was just a mess. It was a scrambled egg mess, as we talked about before. So being able to bring some sort of clarity to what the hell's going on in a movie like that, I think, you need a strong, a director with a strong voice.
Yeah. It would be so great if Mel Gibson directed Mel Gibson directed superhero movie would be great.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to distance yourself from Mel Gibson, you know, distance the work from the artist, but would be great.
I mean, and that's the thing, it's like, when he's talking movies, when he's talking story, Mel Gibson's a really good storyteller.
Yeah.
And I think, again, that's really what we want out of it. the rest of his personality aside, it's all about can you tell a story that does justice to these characters and can actually be like a moving, entertaining story.
Yeah.
And I think Mel Gibson is more than capable. It's just that, yeah, he's a very contentious figure. So I'm not gonna go into that. Just go to Wikipedia. Yeah. You can find out all about it if you don't know about it. So that's pretty much it for movie news. I don't remember anything else that's super big that's happening. But that's all we've got in our notes anyway.
Not in our cosmos of pop culture.
Yeah, so we made a conscious decision to try to stick to more of a superhero line here. Because there's a whole bunch of stuff happening, but we can't cover everything. We're not Variety. All right. So speaking of it, the big drop. So Wonder Woman's going into weekend 2. So it's its second weekend. It did really great at the box office last week. So broke a bunch of records with an asterisk. So did really good. So I think it exceeded expectations. Was the biggest opening for a female-directed movie and for a female-led actioner. So really good stuff there. And that was the asterisk I was talking about, you know, in terms of when you look at it from a female director point of view and a female main character action movie point of view, sort of broke all of those. But as we go into the second weekend, everyone is watching what the percentage drop is going to be at the box office. So if it drops around, so normally movies drop around 60%. So that's kind of like average.
Yeah.
But because Wonder Woman's got such strong word of mouth and ratings on Rotten Tomatoes, it's still at like 93%. Ooh, in weekend 2.
Right.
So that's quite good. They're looking for a 50% drop a 50% drop compared to the first weekend, compared to the opening weekend. Yeah. So if it does that's already above average and doing quite well. Some people are talking a 40% drop. So it'll, like, if it does like a 40% drop, then it's extremely well. It already beat The Mummy.
Yeah, but you know,
The Mummy kind of crashed and burned.
That's heavy. That trailer is such an insult to the intelligence of the audience. When the banner, the text,
Dark Universal,
the text that's displayed tells you "Welcome to a universe of monsters," and it cuts to Russell Crowe with a glass of wine in his hand saying "Welcome to a universe of monsters." And I said, "Thank you, Russell Crowe. I just read that. You're amazing. Really, that's what you've become." Great job.
Yeah. And it's weird. It's weird the way they position that, because Universal is trying to build a monster franchise. So they're going back and looking at Dracula, Frankenstein, The Mummy, The Wolfman, I believe, as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're putting together this monster franchise. So all of these monsters would exist in the same world. But when they advertised The Mummy, which was supposed to be kicking off this whole franchise, They made it look like it's a Tom Cruise movie. Yep. They didn't make it look like it's a monster franchise movie.
Yep.
They pretty much said, Tom Cruise, look, it's a Tom Cruise movie. And if you look at the box office numbers, it kind of did as well as a Tom Cruise movie does, you know? So if you just watch any generic Tom Cruise movie, that's the kind of box office Tom Cruise has when he's not in a franchise. Because if it's a franchise, if it's like Mission Impossible, he does a lot better and the movie does a lot better. But if it's just a generic out of a franchise Tom Cruise movie, then he does... like he did.
I think it would have worked better, but not with Tom Cruise, if he'd played The Mummy and they
that would have been interesting. That would have been a great take on it, because one of the cool things is, I mean, Tom Cruise is really good in an action movie. Like, if you want to watch a good action movie, Tom Cruise is not going to let you down, right? But at the same token, all of his characters end up being kind of the same. It's the same action. He's like an action athlete. Like, he puts a lot of effort into like the stunts, the action sequences are great. He's running all over the place. You know, it's like this dude's putting in work. But the problem is whether he's playing Ethan Hunt from Mission Impossible or Jack Reacher or, like, I don't know, every other Tom Cruise action hero, he's effectively playing Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Because all of those characters just blend into just an amorphous Tom Cruise-iness about them. And we got the same thing in this movie. So it felt like Ethan Hunt or Jack Reacher ended up fighting off this mummy. Whereas, I get your point, if he was the mummy, if he was covered in all of that makeup, so you couldn't really tell that it's Tom Cruise, but he was being Tom Cruise as the mummy, that would have been interesting.
Yeah, and he wouldn't even have to be the villain, because I think the overall plan is to establish redo Monster Squad. So why not?
Well, it's kind of like the Universal Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
It's like the Wolfman teaming up with the Mummy and Dracula. Yeah. So Wonder Woman has crushed the Mummy and is going into a second weekend. And Kevin Feige, in great Marvel fashion, has dropped the Black Panther teaser trailer to make all the conversation about Black Panther this weekend and not Wonder Woman specifically.
Yeah.
That's great. Great marketing strategy there. So that was dropped during game 4 of the NBA, which makes me sound like I know what I'm talking about, but I really don't. But yeah, I was like, whoa, this is so cool. I've watched it like 3 or 4 times already. So we're going to do just a quick teaser trailer review. What did you think about it?
First of all, I liked it. And again, it's bright. It's sunny. It has color in it.
Oh, it looks fantastic. Amazing. The colors look amazing.
And you know what's awesome? I finally can watch a movie with my nieces where 90% of the cast looks like them because they're Austro-African descent, and they're girls, and there are badass girls in the teaser, and I guess in the final movie as well. Yeah, and Martin Freeman. Yeah,
it's like it is. I mean, there's not a lot more to say because it's kind of like kind of everything I've always wanted. It's kind of like the promise has been kept, I think is what I tweeted when I saw it. And it's because there's a lot riding on the shoulders of Black Panther, just like there was a lot riding on the shoulders of Wonder Woman in terms of expectation, what it needs to be and what it needs to represent for the character that this is talking about. I'm just kind of losing my words right now. But yeah, so like there's a lot of expectation. They could have played it in a way that would have been diminutive. They could have played it in a way that could have just really been make people tune out. But I think it's currently walking that really fine line between being something that you need to pay attention to or something that you can outright dismiss, you know? And I think it's swaying towards the I need to pay attention to this.
Yeah.
Well, one, it's a Marvel movie, so you're going to pay attention, right? But in the way that they've put the trailer together, it's really interesting. They, like you said, it's a movie with like 90% of black cast, but they start off with the two main white characters. And that's kind of like the introduction. It's kind of drawing you in, you know? And it's not just two white characters. It's two like really cool character actors that we have in the world of cinema right now. So Martin Short and Martin Freeman.
But Martin Short would be amazing as Everett Ross. Man.
I want to see Martin Short as Everett. Can we have him? So it's Martin Freeman, a.k.a. Bilbo Baggins, and Andy Serkis, a.k.a. Gollum.
Every CGI character ever.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so Andy Serkis normally, he does all the motion capture, because he did Gollum from The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and he did Caesar from the Planet of the Apes movies.
And
I'm sure he's done other stuff as well.
How's the girl? Snoke in Star Wars The Force Awakens?
Oh, did he? I didn't know he did Snoke. There you go. So you've never really seen his face before. So he's playing Ulysses Klaue, and Martin Freeman is playing...
Everett Ross, safety attaché of Wakanda.
So he's like a part of a United Nations.
In the movie verse, he's a United Nations representative.
Yeah. And the trailer starts off with them having this conversation where Martin Freeman's kind of like interviewing Ulysses Klaue, but Ulysses Klaue is just owning that, and Martin Freeman's just doing the Martin Freeman reaction shots.
Yes, yeah. You know? That's a great
thing. Which is great.
Doesn't matter what he does. He doesn't belong there.
Yeah, and Ulysses Klaue, so Andy Serkis has this South African accent, which I can actually, I can rate, you know, being born in South Africa, like that's a pretty convincing accent, so that's pretty good. So, yeah, because otherwise, like you look at Leonardo DiCaprio, I thought his accent in Blood Diamond was awful, but Andy Serkis does a pretty good job, and it just looks like he's having so much fun. Like, he's just like, he's so happy to be on camera, you know, like, yes, I'm not covered in dots. Being recorded for motion capture. And then they show you Wakanda. Like, then they sort of, they do this voiceover. And I'm kind of like stepping through the trailer, kind of like scene by scene. They do this voiceover, which kind of also goes from talking about how people think, you know, when they think of Africa, when they think of Wakanda, it's a third world country. But that's just it's just a guise, it's just a story, because the real Wakanda is the super advanced hidden city, and they liken it to the city of El Dorado. So I mean, coming out of it, I don't think they're saying it's like literally El Dorado,
no.
But they're saying it's the hidden city of gold that everyone's been looking for, but it doesn't exist in South America. They were looking in the wrong place. It's in Africa, and it's been there all along. And then they show you what it looks like, and it's just, it's so cool. Like, that's the, it, you know, every time people think of Africa, every time people think of like what it would be like to go to Africa, you know, you kind of think about all the World Vision starving children imagery that you see on TV, and people needing help, people needing to be rescued or to be saved. Whereas when they show you Wakanda, it's, you know, it's that, it's a place that doesn't need help. You know, it's so far advanced and so far beyond, but still celebrates its culture and its heritage, and not, it's not a super westernized version of that. Like, you know, the version of modernity in Wakanda is not a capitalist consumption modernity. It's still got very much its Africanness about it, which just looks so cool. And it's great for people, you know, in Africa to see that, because, you know, that's like a representation of, you know, we are not just the people living in the desert without food to eat or land to farm kind of thing. Like, you know, this is a vision of the future that is ours alone.
Yeah, this is something we can aspire to in the real world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we don't have to give up our heritage in order to get it, you know? Like, it celebrates the African heritage, which, well, you know, as in a fictional way, because it's a fictional country and it's a fictional heritage, but it celebrates a lot of that. Like, there's one scene in there which I thought was like, whoa, that's pretty extreme. But there's a dude dressed up in, like, he looks like he's dressed to, like, so that, yeah, you're going to...
In the suit with the stretched lower lip?
Yes, with the lip disc, or the plate lip, or whatever they call it. So he's dressed up in, like, this fabulous suit. He's got, like, a walking... I think he's got a cane, looking very...
business? Well,
it's not even business. He's, like, he's got flamboyant swagger, you know? Like, he's
Imperial swagger.
Imperial swagger. He's dressed up, and he's got the plate lip.
Yep.
And the plate in his lip actually matches the suit. And it all fits together, like it's a fashion statement.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's going to play out in the movie itself.
But it's a great visual.
Yeah, I mean, but it's a great visual. So it's cool as well to kind of push that, the plate lip thing, you know. I think in Western culture, people see it as a bit, you know, it tends to be ridiculed a little bit in terms of the impression that people have of it. So I think it's a bold statement by Ryan Coogler and the creative team to put it in the movie and present it as, this is a dude that needs to be taken fully seriously, because he's coming across as a pretty important figure in this room. Like, he's the center of the room. He owns his presence in that room.
Yeah.
And he's got a plate lip, you know, and you've just got to deal with it. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that scene plays out. I don't know who he is and what he's doing in the movie, but it looks like it's going to be an interesting scene to watch. And that, like, in the trailer, it's only like, I think it's like, 1/3 of a second or something. It's so not striking. Very quick.
But then I've watched a lot of documentaries as a kid, and I was always intrigued by African tribes and the body modifications that they do, like the women with the stretched necks.
Yeah.
And the lip plates and everything fascinated me as a child.
Yeah. I think it still happens in some tribes. Yeah. And it also happens in South America. So there are some South American tribes, and I think some Native American tribes that do similar body modifications as well. That's a whole other topic. But yeah, so I mean, like, so it's not just, it's not a specific African thing. Like, going back to my anthropological view of things, it's something that has existed as a part of human culture. So it's interesting to see it presented in this sort of format in a superhero movie of all things, you know. But then going back to Wakanda, like, it's great the way they've presented the city as well, as a super modern city with all of these glass tall skyscrapers.
Yeah.
His jets, obviously, like the Quinjet that the Avengers have, but then also the very kind of down to earth, rootsy, you know, like going back to basics about being a part of an African tribe, It looks like there's a lot of stuff in there with ceremonies. They've got facial paint, the tattoos. He's got this really cool, looks like a panther motif tattoo on his back. Yeah, it's like the movie's looking fantastic. The action sequences that they showed in the trailer look great as well. Like, he's the thing that sets him apart from the other movies is, I mean, as well as the suit being bulletproof and just awesome in a like in a gunfight, because why would you even bother shooting at him? Because everything just bounces off.
I think that that's becoming a trope, somebody emptying a clip on him, because it was in Civil War, and I think it was in the trailer as well, and now we have it here.
Yeah. Well, and so a part of the thing is, I think with him specifically, he's the Black Panther and Wakanda has been secret for so long. So it's been in the world the whole time, and they've never really revealed themselves. But it's only now, since the Avengers and since, and not even so much since Civil War, but just prior to Civil War happening and the previous king of Wodonga was the town I lived in previously in Australia. The previous king of Wakanda dying, they were saying, we want to engage more with the world,
yeah.
You know? So those Wakandans were killed when Scarlet Witch exploded the bomb in Nairobi, I think it was.
Yes.
Yeah, at the beginning of... That was the beginning of Civil War. And that's when Wakanda was like, as a country, we need to come out of the shadows. We need to engage with the world more. And so for the longest time, they've been hidden and they haven't... Nobody knows anything about the Black Panther and the fact that you can't shoot him. And so that's why I think every time he shows up, they're like, just shoot him, because that's all we do, right? You know, if I've got a gun, I'm going to shoot him. But then he just... absorbs the energy from the bullets, and the bullets bounce off him, you know? So it's a great visual. And then he's jumping and he's leaps through the air, and he's got this gymnast grace with cat-like movement, just the way he moves around and lands and stuff like that. It's just really, really cool to watch. It's almost like watching action ballet, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's just fantastic.
And the only thing I'm missing is, because the trailer feels like the movie's gonna borrow from the current Black Panther comic book heavily, because that's also dealing with the realities of Africa in juxtaposition with the fictional world of Wakanda, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. But the greatest thing that came out of, not the greatest thing that came out of it, but a great visual is his suit that's kind of assembling around him in these circuitry patterns. And I wish they would have put something. I wish they would put something like that in the movie, that it's not just a mask, but this, and not just a suit, not just a metal shirt, a chainmail shirt, just this garment,
yeah.
But really the pinnacle, a pinnacle of technology, also that enhances his natural grace. You know how Iron Man moves about in, I think it was the first time in the Avengers, and the suit get disassembled by this factory.
Oh, when they have to take him out of the suit.
Of the suit, yeah. And now imagine the juxtaposition of the image. Here comes somebody from a nation that we consider to be poor, and he has the same sophisticated costume as Iron Man, and it just gracefully slides off him. Revealing the circuitry. Oh, I mean, it won't happen in the movie, but I was hoping to see something like that in the trailer.
Yeah, I think with Iron Man, yeah, I know what you're saying. It's like at the start. So if you look at like Avengers, I think the first Avengers, he's got like the platform that he walks in.
Yes.
And then as he's walking down the platform, the little robotic arms come and they actually take bits of the suit off.
Off, yeah.
You know, and that's how he kind of gets out of the suit. But now he's progressed to the stage where if you look at the Spider-Man Homecoming trailer, he can effectively, the Iron Man suit can like hover in a spot and Tony Stark can step out of it. So it just kind of, like opens up and he can just step out. And then of course Tony Stark steps out. So this is the scene in the Homecoming trailer where he's telling Peter Parker that he wants the suit back. He wants the spider suit back. And he's wearing like a Tom Ford suit,
yeah.
You know, like Tony Stark's like decked out in like this perfectly tailored suit, and he's inside the Iron Man armor, and the suit's like not even wrinkled when he steps out.
Yes.
It's fantastic. So I think, you know, if you look at the nature of the Iron Man armor, because it's like armor, it lends itself to that. Whereas the Spider-Man Homecoming suit, like the suit is actually, it's got like, I don't know what they call it, but it's kind of like this big baggy suit, and then it like fits to your body shape.
Yeah.
So it's not stretchy. It kind of like, it gets like suctioned in once Spider-Man puts it on. So it like conforms to his body shape kind of thing. So I like that the suits are different in that way. And so what I'm interested in, because Wakanda has been separated from the world for so long, their technology has kind of evolved in parallel with our technology.
Yeah.
So I would like to see a variation of that. So it would be a third kind of how can the suit work? So it's not something, it's not clothes that he puts on, but it's got some sort of, I would really like some sort of nano scale thing about it, whether it's like robotics or nano weave or whatever he's doing with that vibranium. That would be really cool.
I can't wait. You know, I've talked to Susie about it yesterday. It's really unfortunate that they put the teaser out so early, because the movie comes out in February next year, I think.
Oh, really? It's that far away,
they're
right?
Already teasing us. It's more than half a year away, and I already want to see that movie. I'm so pumped for that movie.
Yeah, so the marketing campaign is quite interesting. I mean, and it's a teaser, right? So it's like a 1 minute teaser, yeah. I believe. What we're waiting for now, it's probably only going to be months away. So more towards the end of the year is probably the first trailer.
Yeah.
So the first trailer, because I think at this stage they're still work. You know, they wouldn't have had a lot of time to do a lot of the special effects and post-production.
No. I think they work towards the teaser now and are continuing the work on the broader movie yet and on the trailer.
Yeah, and I think Marvel does a really good job at that. Like in terms of the way they put together their shooting schedule, they're like, all right, we need to have a couple of key shots in our marketing, so get those filmed first, and then we can edit them for the teaser trailer. And then down the line, once they've got the post-production done with special effects and things like that, then they can put that into the first full trailer. But it does, it looks really good. I think in terms of the tone, in terms of the look and feel, and what we're seeing with the way they've presented Wakanda and the characters, it's really awesome.
Yeah.
And speaking of girl power, I mean, the Dora Milaje, who are his, the imperial bodyguard, royal bodyguard of Wakanda. They just look so cool. Yep. They just look fantastic. I can't wait for that.
Yeah.
And it's like, I was thinking about that the other day as I was walking like from my room into the kitchen or something. And I'm just, you know, I'm thinking of that line that, the Dora Milaje said when, Scarlett Johansson. So when Black Widow was trying to talk to T'Challa in Civil War, and she's standing at the car, and then the Dora Milaje lady walks up and she's like, "Move or you will be moved." You know,
yes.
Like that is such a badass line. I love it. I love it. Okay. So very excited about Black Panther, clearly. Hopefully it stays on that track and it lives up to the expectations, the very high expectations that we have.
Yeah. With Wonder Woman performing as well as it does, they have to make this one a hit.
Yeah.
The bar has been set high for Marvel.
Yeah, that it has. And I think, you know, and with Wonder Woman as well, not just Black Panther, but also Captain Marvel coming up. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting take to see how they differentiate. So what they learn from the Wonder Woman journey and story, for how that movie was put together and how it was received, to how they frame Captain Marvel when she's finally released into the world, you know, in movie form. And it's interesting because tonally there's very, very clear differences in the characters. So I know we've got a Wonder Woman review coming up, but just while we're still on the Marvel track, you know, the way they've cast Brie Larson compared to Gal Gadot. Yep. So Brie Larson's a much more, I think, girl next door type of figure, because Gal Gadot is kind of more like your model type figure, right? And then also Wonder Woman being a god or being from a line of mythological divinity, I guess. Whereas Captain Marvel's just a human who gets some powers, you know? So it'll be interesting to see how that is dealt with as well.
Yeah, but, you know, fitting in the Marvel formula, mostly regular people being put in extraordinary situations or circumstances.
Yeah.
Brie Larson fits as Captain Marvel, Gal Gadot, like actress. Wouldn't they fit into the overall look, I think? Now, I won't course correct the statement. I think it's the right fit because I thought of whoever plays Scarlet Witch and Scarlett Johansson playing Black Widow, and those are both considered beyond average looking persons.
And it comes down to, you know, effectively Marvel is building a very specific universe. You know, like there's a high level of orchestration.
Yeah.
Whereas I think it's not just casting the most beautiful person irrespective of how they fit in with everyone else in the script. Because even, like, who would have thought, like, even Star-Lord.
Yes. Chris Pratt.
Chris Pratt. I was thinking Chris Pine the whole time. Even Chris Pratt, like, it's kind of like a left-field choice.
Yeah.
But the way they're putting together these movies and they're putting together the personalities, because I think Marvel's keeping an eye on the longer-term view, is that eventually they're going to need all these characters to come together. And if too many of them look and feel the same,
yeah,
then it's not going to work because, why have three versions of the same character with different names? Just have one character to do that role.
Yeah.
You know? And it's kind of like the whole Rick Flagg thing in Suicide Squad. Like, his whole character was really superfluous to the whole thing. He really had nothing to do, so. All right. So, while we're still on Marvel and trailers, I guess we can just do a quick roundup of Iron Fist and the Defenders. So, what have we heard? What have we heard with Iron Fist?
Iron Fist... It's not official now, but it seems like it's getting renewed for a second season. And the rumored announcement couldn't have come at a worse time because two Netflix shows got cancelled. And I only remember Sense8 to be one of them. And that pissed a lot of people off. I haven't seen Sense8 yet. It's on my to-watch list.
Have you seen season one or not?
No. Nothing, but it The premise sounds interesting.
The premise was quite intriguing. The show itself, so I just watched Sense8 season. So I've seen season one. I watched season two, episode one, the other night, actually, because I haven't caught up on season two yet. It's a fantastic show to watch. It's just put together really well. The concept is about eight people around the world who are all born at the exact time. And so they share a connection, so they can effectively hear each other's thoughts and be in each other's minds. They're called a cluster, effectively. So what that means is that they can learn from each other's experiences. They can help each other out. So if, like, one of them has learnt, effectively, martial arts, then the others can tap into that knowledge to be able to defend themselves, for example. And they can also visit each other so that they're all spread in different parts of the world. One's in Iceland, one's in Chicago, one's in India, one's in Germany, and they're just kind of like all over the place, but they can visit each other in their different locations and they can talk to each other. So they build a relationship up with each other and then they can tap into each other's memories and feelings. It's quite a cool concept. The concept is that because they're a cluster that exists, they're being hunted down because they're kind of seen as an abomination. Okay. So the world looks very normal. Everything else exists in the world as you would normally expect it to exist. It's just that there's a secret part of the government and a secret organization that's effectively hunting down these clusters wherever they can find them. Because they're not the only cluster in the world, but they're the one that is the topic of the show, apparently.
Okay.
What I like about it, so it's filmed in all of these locations, like South Korea, Iceland, Germany and India and all these places. And the visuals... The photography is just fantastic as you go and flip between these different locations. Because the characters, you know, like the girl in South Korea will end up in Africa because she needs to talk to the guy who's in Africa. And so she would be, it's a little bit confusing sometimes when you're watching it to say, like, all right, who can actually see who in the scene? Because, like, the girl will be in Africa with the guy who's from Africa, but he can, and he'll talk to her because she's effectively in his head, but nobody else in Africa can see him.
Mm-hmm.
And she's still wearing the clothes that she's wearing when she was in Korea.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like the level of detail and the way they've put the show together is really cool. What I like about it is that it shows that no matter where in the world you are, your experience, the things you're going through, the challenges you're having as a human being is almost universal.
Yeah.
And so the whole premise of the show is that, you know, there's different types of people, there's different people around the world, but we're all intrinsically the same and we're dealing with the same very similar problems. And it's cool too, because, you know, as well as the different geographical differences, there's also there's gay couples, there's straight couples. Sometimes they've got partners outside of the cluster, which makes things which makes things very interesting. Because they're like always talking to someone, and then their other half will be like,
who are you talking to?
It's like, what's going on? It's done really well. I really enjoyed the show. It's a little bit dark. It does get very dark. The action is good, but it's very sporadic. And I think a part of the show is that the pacing is a bit off. There's a lot of character work happening. There's obviously 8 main characters. And so it's constantly flipping, trying to give you insight into each of these characters, but then also have enough of a overarching story and enough of a dramatic tension to keep you watching the next episode. And sometimes it feels like it's a bit overdrawn with how much of character work they're putting in, because things are not moving so fast for the plot to progress. And then, yeah, it's an interesting show. There's also, like, you know, like I said, because they share their feelings and they can all be with each other, it makes for some very interesting intimate scenes. I'll put it that way.
Of course, yeah.
So
I've read The Time Traveler's cool. Wife, and, you know, time travelers having sex with earlier versions of themselves or later versions of themselves.
I've not read that. Yeah. I didn't know that was in there, but there you go. So yes, some pretty interesting sex scenes in Sense8 as well. I really like it though. I was a bit sad that season 3 was not picked up for a third season. I don't know how season 2 ends, so I don't know if that's going to annoy me. But I quite like the characters, and I quite like the story or the journey that those characters are going on in trying to, you know, a lot of them are fighting. They're trying to work out their identity for themselves as well as being a part of this cluster. And so it's interesting just to sort of see how that comes together. And then also there's the organization that's hunting them down, and that adversary is a piece of work as well. So he's quite cool. So I'm going to finish season 2 at least. And then, you know, I'll get angry that there's no season 3 after I do that.
And that's the sad thing. You make it sound really interesting. And I think, you know, with Iron Fist being the, well, not disaster, but the sword thump,
the letdown
of the Marvel, yeah, the letdown of the Marvel series. I'm not getting why they are renew. Well, I mean, it's not confirmed yet, but why they are renewing it for season 2 and not let go the Heroes for Hire route. But also what you told me about Sense8, introducing a antagonistic organization that is hunting those guys down feels like a bit much. It would be interesting just to see the usual lives of the cluster, because that's already such a great idea and a parable to the internet generation, so to say. We share so much stuff over social media, and I feel like it's kind of a comment on that on an evolutionary level.
It is. I mean, yeah, it's like, at that stage, are they still human? They're effectively a networked
entity,
species.
Yeah. Yeah,
species. They're a networked entity, because that cluster effectively can be seen as one organism in a way. And so it's interesting. And I think that's the problem I was talking about with the pacing before, is that they spend almost too much time just to looking at the characters. And because they do, there's a lot of lingering shots. Like, they're beautiful shots to watch because of the locations, and the photography and the cinematography is just so good. But at the same time, you're like, all right, move on. I know the bad guy's out there. You know, why are you guys having a Christmas special right now? It's like, you know what? Don't we have more important things to do?
Yeah.
You know,
that's something that puts me off. That I say I'd watch the Christmas special, yeah, but I'm just on a low conflict media route these days.
Yeah. I just, if there's going to be tension, if there's going to be a, I'm very much plot driven. I mean, I'm plot driven as well as character driven, but I like there to be a good balance. If the plot is just not going anywhere, I get bored sometimes.
Of course.
Especially if the characters are just going around in circles. So, and I think that's the problem is with the show, is that the character stories by themselves are not strong enough to keep the episodes going. Like, if it was more of a soap opera and the character relationship stories were pushing things forward, then that's fine.
Yeah.
But at the moment, it's kind of like in Game of Thrones, where you know that you're waiting for the final battle, and you know that these, you know, the Dragon Queen's going to land on King's Landing, and like that's what you're waiting for. That's like going to be the payoff, right? All the other things that happen are still intriguing, because that's why it's taken 6 seasons to get to this point, you know? So all those other things have kept the show going so far, but eventually that Dragon Queen needs to get there and you need to have the final battle. And Sensei, you know, the problem is the character stories have not been compelling enough, I thought. Or, you know, they've been interesting, but they haven't been, like, really pushing things forward. And then with the cluster story in season two, I've only seen one episode. Season one ended, I think, pretty well. But with season two, they would have needed to have picked up that the pace. I don't know. Like, this turned into very much a Sense8 review, and it really wasn't meant to be. But, you know, it's a good show. I don't know whether it's worth to watch it now that season three has not been picked up, because I don't know how season two ends. But if season two ends on a way that is kind of like does wrap up a few things, then at least then it will be worth it. But the thing that you're seeing now is that Netflix, you know, I think they went on a long tack of just spending a lot of money to make a lot of movies and shows,
yeah,
and buy a lot of content. But now they're kind of reining things back a little bit, and I think they're being more picky about what they carry on with and what they don't.
Yeah.
And I think Sense8, to its own detriment, was a very expensive show to make.
Yes, the logistics of what you describe must be a hellish task to orchestrate.
Organized, yeah. And I think The Crown as well is a super expensive show. And I think that's the thing. It's like, if it's going to be that expensive, it needs to perform, you know? If it's going to be a cheap show, then sure. But if it's going to be super expensive, then it needs to make sure it's also commercially viable. It can't only be a massive art enterprise.
Yeah, and as long as Netflix doesn't give us viewing numbers. And
well, we don't know for sure.
Keeps the metrics to themselves.
Yeah. But I think Sense8 did have a very, it was kind of a niche market because it didn't, but, you know, it really only trended, I think, for a large part when it was canceled.
Yeah.
When the season dropped, when the first season was happening, it didn't really trend on Twitter. It didn't really have a high buzz factor.
Yeah. But then I'm just pulling things out of my ass, but perhaps it was a plan from Netflix all along. And because viewing numbers could get a boost from the cancellation statement, perhaps they see fit to at least end the show in like a shorter season to at least give fans a jumping off point.
Well, yeah, I'm here. I hope it's worth. Yeah, I don't know, but we'll see. But yeah, you're right. I mean, so what does that mean then in terms of Iron Fist? I think I don't know. I think Iron Fist, hopefully it was not that expensive to produce.
It's such a strange decision.
And it's an acceptable, it could be an acceptable loss and a gamble that they're willing to take at this point to do a season two, especially if that season two is going to help bridge into the large tapestry of stories that they want to tell. Because I think that the Defenders franchise that they're building with all of this is, you know, it's not just a once-off thing. So they've got a larger plan. And I think hopefully they're being a little bit more, I'm going to use the words, fiscally responsible with how they're creating these shows, so that even if one of the shows doesn't rate as high as it should or that they want it to, they can still continue with the overall plan and accept that loss.
Yeah. Which brings us to The Defenders, which allegedly will take place over a period of only 48 hours, which doesn't give me much hope in terms of character development and make it a rather plot-driven affair.
Yeah, but saying that, I mean, Avengers only took place across, what, 2 or 3 days?
Yeah, something like that. I think it's even shorter, 2 days or something like that.
Yeah. So, and I think that's the payoff that you have once each of these characters have had full seasons of build up, that you can now just make them play, you know? Now you can play. So,
yeah, I hope you're right.
And so I'm not too worried about that specifically, because we do know these characters quite well. We know what their failings are, we know what their weaknesses are. And seeing them all come together and work together, we could see them each grow and by pushing against each other rather than going through a massive story arc, you know? So I think it could work. I think from what I've seen of the first trailer, it's still kind of iffy. It still kind of looks a little bit cheap to me.
Yeah.
Iron Fist is still the weakest link in this whole thing, you know?
It smells like Iron Fist all over again.
Yeah, but it's being, yeah, I don't know. Is it, you know?
I'm an IFist apologist, but it's not like I want to see the whole thing again.
Yeah, it needs to go somewhere. I felt Iron Fist was a little bit weak in its story and its characters. But this one here, like the payoff of everything that's been set up, I think. And really, Daredevil, to me, it feels like Daredevil's been doing a lot of the heavy lifting with where the Defenders is going. Like the whole thing with Elektra and what they were doing with the hand. Was it the hand?
Yeah.
Yeah, the hand. You know, all of that was set up in Daredevil, and the team that's putting the Defenders together is the Daredevil Season 2 team. So hopefully, you know, they're seeing that as an extension of the story that they've been telling all along. Whereas Luke Cage, Jessica Jones, and Iron Fist came in from different directions. And they didn't have a lot of... I didn't see a lot of overlap.
Yep.
Like, it would have been cool if Wilson Fisk had more of a role in Iron Fist or Jessica Jones. Like, you know, that so we could see a bit more of that dark figure, like kind of like the Thanos-type figure in the background of all of this thing pulling strings. But it just kind of was missing, so...
That's the problem. I
don't know.
I know people who only watched Jessica Jones and Luke Cage because they're not interested in Daredevil or Iron Fist. They're just... They specifically watch those characters and they have no idea about the Defenders and they're not even sure if they are going to watch any further seasons of Jessica Jones and/or Luke Cage because of the Scarlet Letter that gets applied to them with the Defenders.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, to be seen. To be seen whether the Defenders ends up being the end of this whole thing, and then that's why they decide with Iron Fist 2. It's like, they're like, you know what, Marvel TV, we're not gonna be working with you guys anymore. We're gonna move on to do something else.
Yeah.
Oh well. Cool. So that pretty much takes care of our TV news then. And I guess we can move on to the main topic.
To the main event.
The main event, our Wonder Woman review or catch up.
Yeah.
So We got a bit of an intro, so I'm just going to intro the intro. So what we've done is we've actually asked a couple of our friends to give us their input on what they were expecting about Wonder Woman and also what they thought about Wonder Woman after they'd seen it. So these are just people that we know. So what we're going to do now before we go into our Wonder Woman review is just play the intro for what expectations were from the people that we know. So cue the tape. What do you know about Wonder Woman?
Firstly, she's kick-ass, and she's a symbol of girl power. And although I didn't really watch much of the series and stuff that was out there growing up, you know, my perception of her has always been a strong, powerful female leader. And, you know, she's just a force to be reckoned with.
I know the basics. I never followed her very closely in comics or comic TV shows, anything like that. But I know of her powers and some of her backstory, what she's about.
Okay, I don't know very much about Wonder Woman. I know she is an iconic figure and one of the only lead female characters, I think, in Marvel Comics. And I assume she has special powers. I don't exactly know what they are, but I'm hoping that they have to do with strength and intelligence and showing some of the guys how it's done.
And what are you expecting from this movie?
Very excited. I've heard very good things so far, but I also know that the DCU doesn't have the best track record. I'm very disappointed by Batman vs. Superman. It's Batman vs. Superman. How do you screw that up? They managed to do it. So based off of that, I think it's going to be very good. But again, it's, you know, in a different category since it is a comic book movie. I don't really judge that the same as, you know, something that is nominated for an Oscar. So I think within comparing it to other comic book movies, it'll probably do fairly well. But we'll see.
I am very excited to see Wonder Woman. I'm looking forward to hopefully having a lot of action and good music. And hopefully some humor in there, too. And I'm excited to see some girl power and to see Wonder Woman kick some butt.
Well, at first, when I knew that they were making the film, I was kind of like, ooh, I don't know how this is going to go. Because all the previous films, the DC films that have come out, have kind of been miss, really, not even hit or miss, it's just been miss. And they've all been really dark, quite depressing, not a lot of excitement going on. So I wasn't too sure how this was going to come out. But, you know, recently I've been hearing a lot of buzz around it. People, the Rotten Tomatoes reviews, for example, have been really high. So I, you know, I'm going in with high hopes. And I really like Gal Gadot, like from when I watched Batman versus Superman, which I thought her appearance was the best thing in that whole blimmin' film anyway. I thought, you know, she plays the part really well, at least from what I saw there. And not to mention, she's absolutely beautiful, but at the same time, is really strong and powerful in how she holds herself. So yeah, I'm really excited to see how this turns out.
And we're back.
All right, so what did you think of Wonder Woman, Martin?
Okay. This is
sorry. I just threw that out to you.
No. I wrestle since I've seen it 2 days ago. I'm wrestling with how to answer that question because it definitely is an important movie. I'm sure it will do for superhero movies what Deadpool did for Wolverine. show that things can work in another way with another set of characters.
Yeah.
But for me, the movie should have ended as soon as Steve Trevor crashed on Themyscira, and they should have just cut his throat, because I think the movie not falls apart, but gets less enjoyable for me afterwards, because while it's still entertaining, and that something is missing, especially in the last act, I think the whole thing comes apart. It does not collapse under the weight that has been put upon its shoulders in the first two parts of the movie, but you can definitely feel the strain of having to juggle all the weights that have been thrown at Wonder Woman in this case.
You think Diana's balancing too many things on her shoulders at the end of the movie,
especially given the setting, given the mythology of the movie. Yeah, that's a whole other can of worms to open.
Yeah.
But then it's a good DC movie, and I'm so glad that this could be it is the movie that is critically acclaimed and makes money, and that's a great thing, and I'm really happy.
Well, you
for
want
DC.
That's like the two big things that you want. I get you want it to have, you know, well received by the industry and the audience.
And I'm happy for DC and the audience, because we get a good movie with a property that a lot of people love. It shows us something new, a new way to treat characters.
I think, you know, I agree with you on a lot of points, but I also think that's why, to me, the movie worked, because I think it did have the last act had clear issues. And just to be clear, this is going to be a spoiler warning.
Or
a spoiler review. So we're going to totally go into like all of the details. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, wait till you've seen it and then listen to this. Like, just the thing with like after Ares is killed and like all the German soldiers or the Axis soldiers start like hugging each other and everyone's like, you know, happy, happy, joy, joy, love, love. It's just too far, you know? So that was kind of like a weird decision to make. It's like, oh, take off your masks. Oh, you're just young, innocent kids. Oh, let's just all hug it out. That was a bit stupid. But I think what I really liked, and I think to your point, was that this was such a refreshing take on what a hero is and like how a hero acts and behaves. And, you know, let's just keep it in the context of the DC universe. I think in the set of characters that they've created, you've got Batman, who's just driven by this anger and, you know, this rage. You've got Superman, who's just lost. Like, this version of Superman is just like, you know, what do I do? I don't care about saving people, and I'm going to save him anyway. You know, whatever. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm a god. I'm just going to hover here and let you see me for a while before I come down and save you. You know, it's like, it's just a weird version of Superman. Like, Superman is like kind of like the most emo version of Superman I've ever seen. Whereas Wonder Woman, in the way that she's presented, is naive. She's learning about the world.
Yeah.
She's caught between the reality that she grew up with on Themyscira, where she was told all of these myths and legends and this idealistic view around how the world works and how, like, the world of man and men were created to be good, but Ares corrupted them. And so everything they do is because Ares corrupted them. So everything that they do that's bad is because Ares corrupted them. And hence, her view is that, but just by killing Ares, that's how we save humanity. That's how we save the world, kind of thing. And the whole story to me was about her coming out. It's effectively her growing up. She's learning through the course of this movie that idealism is not how the world actually works. And I think that's where the Steve Trevor character played such a crucial role, is in being that voice to help her come to terms with that.
Yeah.
And she's like, I did all the right things. I did everything they told me to do. I did what I was supposed to do, and I killed Ares. Why is this still happening? And that, to me, was where the movie should have ended. So when she kills, what's his name, Ludendorff?
Yeah.
That is the point where I think that was the story that they were telling, is where humanity's complicated. And Steve Trevor says, you know, it's messy and you can't, it's not just going to be a simple answer. But then they do the next 15 minutes, which is the God battle.
Yeah.
Which is a CGI.
With Professor Lumpine, of all people.
Yeah. And everything that they built up to towards that last scene is when she does finally kill the actual Ares. And then everyone starts hugging. And so I think that last part is the part that kind of fell apart for me. It's like, well, what are you trying to say here? Was it Ares' influence that was instigating and perpetuating the war or not? You know? Or was it also that humanity brought its own dark side into that? Because that's effectively what happened. And I think up until that point, it was fantastic. But I think what they needed... And again, this is, you know, it's a superhero movie, so it's almost like you need to have your obligatory special effects laden.
Yeah. In the dark.
Explosion fest, you know? In the dark. Yeah. And so I think, you know, putting that aside, what I really liked about the character of Wonder Woman was the fact that she came in with this idealism. She came in with this view of wanting to help and having a very clear thought on how to help, but then just seeing the messiness of the whole situation and seeing the complexities of things involved. And I think that's a part of the journey that where it sort of sets up her as a different character to what Superman is and what Batman is. And that's why they are the holy trinity of the DC universe. You know, she really brings in the compassion and that view of sometimes you don't need a heavy hand to get something done.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you do because she's a warrior princess, you know, but at the same time, but it's not always about that. Like you aren't doing it out of rage and you're not doing it out of duty or spite. You're doing it out of compassion,
yeah.
You know, and I think that perspective was very refreshing to me. I mean, you can say it's kind of a feminine type approach, but at the same time, I think it was just such a breath of fresh air, and it's something that this universe really needed.
But because you mentioned the feminine approach compared to how the men act in that movie, they are very flawed people, because they could have played the naivety part of Diana even further up and have the other soldiers in a way educate her about the world. But instead, everybody's flawed and everybody is admitting their flaws. You know, Steve Trevor is stating more than once that he has done some hideous things in the course of the war. The sharpshooter dismisses her trying to ease his nightmares. Then the actor who tells her that he can't find a job because of his skin color the Native American guy helping Steve Trevor despite his people being the source of plight for the Native Americans. I thought that was a very brave thing to do. Everybody learns from each other. I really like that, and it's sad that those people get sidelined at the end, because all three of them probably found their end in the Second World War, or just, you know, I don't think that the sharpshooter had a happy life after World War One, being shell shocked and all. And I wish they would have spent, instead of having the big CGI fight at the end, you know, have some short montages of her visiting those other characters, like the sharpshooter in a home for shell-shocked people. And I just wanted to see a bookend for them. I mean, Steve gets his ending, and you know, the movie didn't really come full circle to me.
Yeah.
Instead of having the jump off the Louvre or the Eiffel Tower at the end, looking all menacing at the character, at the camera, they should have put a bit more compassion into the ending part of the movie, because World War II still happened. So killing Ares wasn't the solution to the malice in man's heart.
Well, Ares is a god. I mean, is he really dead?
She's a god killer, you know?
So, yeah. No, it's true. I think, and I think that's where they should have kind of made better decision about how to end the movie, yep, with Ares being the linchpin that held the whole thing together. You know, I think they could have played that out.
You know,
better.
What I thought would be the ending, because when she killed Ludendorff, I looked at the watch and I saw, hey, there's still 15 minutes of movie left. What could happen? And I thought the notebooks from Professor Poison or Dr. Poison, I thought the Germans would have captured Ares and they manufacture the ultimate mustard gas from his blood or something like that. They have him chained up in a laboratory, and the notebooks contain how do you call it? The dissection notes. Her dissecting Ares. And I thought that that would be the reason for Wonder Woman going berserk and plowing through the army, that the darkness comes from the people themselves and not even Ares could have instilled such feelings of anger towards each other to go to such length to kill each other.
Yeah.
They even bring down the gods, you know, to kill each other.
Well, and to a point, I think, yeah, you know.
And but then Lupin showed up. Yeah.
And that would have been interesting if they got the notebooks, and then World War II, the Nazis got the notebooks, and then it was like Hellboy with the how they were investigating the paranormal side of things, you know? Yeah, anyway, that's a sideways tangent, which is technically the definition of a tangent. Anyway, but I think overall, like, to me, it was still a really good movie.
Yes.
I think, you know, looking at what the critical acclaim, and that, like I said, 93% are Rotten Tomatoes and stuff, it had all of the things that you generally wanted. The story made sense for the most part. The character was good. It showed character growth. I think it was funny. It was funnier than I thought it was going to be. I think Etta Candy, the Steve Trevor's secretary, she wasn't as prolific in the movie, but I think the little bits of her they had was interesting. I don't think she was like a groundbreaking character or anything. Yeah, this is a good light comic relief.
Yeah, but they had they had to get so much done in that movie.
It was still a long movie. Yeah. It's like 2 hours, 20 minutes or something. Like, it was still a pretty long movie. But I think they used the time wisely. I don't think it was had any pacing problems to my mind. I think it was very engaging, because both visually, like, it goes through all of those different locations. It was, primarily set in, you know, we were in Paris, we were in Germany. Yeah.
And then the transition from the no man's land action scene into the village.
Yeah.
It was visually...
It had that sense of, like, things were constantly moving forward. Like, yeah, so you went from Themyscira to London to Paris. Were they in Paris? Or it starts off in Paris anyway. She's in the Louvre. And then to Germany, and then no man's land, and then the village, like you said, then the airfield, you know, and the castle in between somewhere. So, yeah, it was pretty good in terms of pacing and in terms of keeping things moving, so that you didn't feel that things were dragging at any stage, I thought. So I quite enjoyed that. Yeah. And I think the performances were great. I mean, I really loved Gal Gadot in that move, in that role. And Steve Trevor, I thought, Chris Pine?
Yeah.
Chris Pine did a good job as well.
Yeah.
What I just realized is, like, you know how, so Chris Pine, I thought the goodbye sequence was amazing. Like, I thought that was done really well, where she couldn't hear what he was saying. It was weird. It was weird in a movie like this, because you're like, I can see your face, but it had a lot going on there, you know? where it's like she couldn't hear what he was saying because the bomb was still ringing in her ears. But when she remembers it the second time, and it's, you're kind of like, as the audience, like, well, is this what he actually said, or is this what she thinks he said? And I think it's more what she thinks he said, right? Which is like,
okay, I haven't,
I need to do this.
Okay, I haven't seen it from that angle. I haven't interpreted it from that angle. But yes.
Yep. Yeah, but that's almost like a, that's almost like a, that's like an art house movie style ending, you know? It's like, well, did she, did he actually say that? Like, or is that what, just what she thinks he said, you know? And I think it's weird, but, cause that's where she gets her strength from to actually fight back. Like when she fully ascends and taps into her godlike powers.
Yeah.
Or her literal god like powers, cause she's a god now, then, you know, that's where she gets her strength from.
Yeah.
You know, I can save today, but you need to be there to save tomorrow. You know, that was cool. It was a little bit cheesy, but it was cool.
Yeah.
And I thought the way they put that, those scenes together was really good.
You're justifying that scene for me because, you know, I would have done it another way because he already communicated that the watch is very, is something he treasures. And if he just came by, told her something and have gave her a bag or something, you know, could you hold onto that for me while I'm doing this thing? And she's in the act. I mean, that sounds stupid, but if he just had given her the watch and then had taken off, it would have also communicated that he's about to sacrifice himself for the...
Well, he's going to do something quite final.
For the greater good, because I thought it is stupid, because when my ears are ringing and I can't understand the person, I can't understand them in hindsight. Or I can't understand them later from my memory, except if I can read lips and have a photographic memory. It made no sense.
Because you thought she was like, oh, now I remember what he said.
Yeah, that was my first. Right. But then at this point, I was so pissed at Aerys showing up that thing took me out of the movie. And I must admit also the whole that Steve's death gives her the strength to go into god mode. I thought that was a bit cheap for how she was established until this point.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So just randomly before I address her god point, her god mode, Chris Pine was playing a guy named Steve.
Yeah.
And Chris Evans was also playing Steve Rogers. Yeah.
And they both go on a plane.
They both went down in planes. Anyway, so the thing is, like, I heard from some of my friends that when, and so maybe, you know, this might play out in the outro, because what will play after this is what they thought of, Wonder Woman. Once she, you know, because there's a whole thing around it being like such an important feminist movie. And I think, you know, it was an important movie, but everyone's going to take something different away from it. Once she attains godhood, because she's effectively a god, she's no longer human, is it still a feminist type movie at this stage? And it's an interesting question to think about. Like, is she still, because she's not human anymore, she's literally a god. So I think, you know, people are still going to identify, I think maybe girls and little girls still will have a female figure and female superhero that they can look to now. But in terms of what Wonder Woman represents, she's now a god. She's not just a normal lady. She's not like Black Widow, who's just like off the streets, you know. And the fact that every time she was in an action sequence, her hair and makeup was perfect. Like, she can step out into no man's land and like take down machine gun fire, and like her hair is still perfect.
Yeah, but then, you know, the diet on the mascara. She doesn't eat shit as we do, so her skin is perfect and her hair is perfect.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not even dust. There's not even like there's not even like dust on her face.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. But then, and this is, yeah, I just, as you've mentioned this, there's a very philosophical point popped up in my head. But, you know, women only need sperm to reproduce. You know, if you take the human experience, having another human being growing in you can be considered a divine act in some way. And if sperm could come from trees, you know, if little sperm packages would grow on trees and women could fertilize themselves, they wouldn't need us. So they kind of already are godlike figures because they are the essential part in keeping our species going, you know? I don't know where that came from, but...
Well, Wonder Woman does say that, you know, when they're lying in the boat. She's like, you know, we've pretty much determined that men are needed for reproduction, but not for pleasure.
Yeah.
not specifically for pleasure. So it's a great call out. It's a great call out.
So even if she attains godhood at the end, I think she still retains that the natural divinity of women.
I like it. Fair enough. Because what we're seeing now is that as these movies come out, there's a little bit more attention being thrown into that area, right? Like even so in Spider-Man Homecoming, Zendaya's performance is effectively a makeup-free performance. Mm-hmm. And it's going to back to that whole thing around representation about being female. Is that, you know, why do I have to put on makeup and why do I have to be seen in a certain light to make other people comfortable? I'm just going to be myself and I'm going to play this role. So this is a different take on Mary Jane, right? So Mary, isn't Daya playing Mary Jane? She is, isn't she?
There is a rumor going around that she's playing the certain daughter of a certain character in the movie that certainly is going to make the movie interesting.
Go on, tell me the rumor.
She's playing the daughter of the Vulture.
Oh, right. She's playing Michael Keaton's daughter.
Yeah.
Oh, that'll be interesting. So there's, I don't know. All right, so it's no Mary Jane, maybe. Who knows? But quite interesting, though, is that, you know, that's her take. So the same thing, you know, on the flip side of Wonder Woman is that, again, she's a god, so that's why her hair and makeup's always perfect. And she's got that model-like figure. And then going back to what we're seeing coming out of Captain Marvel's way is Captain Marvel is going to be a very different type of female hero, you know, and not one that may be exactly, you know, the classic view of what a female hero should be in terms of perfectly proportioned, perfect hair and makeup, always smiling, always, you know, making men comfortable.
Yeah.
And I think that's a choice. Obviously, we don't know yet, but that's a choice that the Marvel side of things are going to have to make based on how they want to create that character and how it fits into their larger universe. But also, like we said before, how they're going to learn from the Wonder Woman experience.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, I'm sure what Zendaya is doing on Spider-Man as well.
And they have to learn because, you know, Wonder Woman proved that female-centric superhero movies can make money. And people are interested in them.
Yeah, there's no longer the excuse, I think. And that's one of the great things about the way Wonder Woman performed at the box office. There's no longer an excuse to say, oh, these movies don't make money.
Yeah.
And they can't make money because people just don't want to see that. I think it's very key is that if you treat it seriously, if you give it all the same seriousness that you give these male-centric heroes in terms of a good story, a good budget, great characterization, proper marketing, you know, and like the whole package, you can have a really good success.
And it's like I said with Black Panther, you know, this is a movie I can show my nieces. I mean, the black persons are not represented in it, but there's a female hero in there. There's this whole island of kick-ass female, of kick-ass women.
Yeah, I'm really excited. So, you know, and not just for little girls, but for little boys as well.
Yeah.
So I think to see that, you know, you don't have to be a man to be a hero and that anyone can have that in them. So again, it's good for both sides. So my niece and nephew actually went to see it last night. So my sister and my brother-in-law took them to the movies. So they saw Wonder Woman last night. I don't know what they thought of it yet because I haven't spoken to them. So I'm looking forward to talking to them tonight to see what they thought. So my little niece was really excited. And I asked her what she thought, like who was Wonder Woman. She really didn't know. I mean, she's like she can fly. That's pretty much her power, and she's strong, you know. So it'll be interesting to see like how she interprets what she watched on the screen based on who Wonder Woman is in the story they told. And the same with my nephew as well, just to sort of get his take on, because this is the first time they would have seen that, like a female hero with this level of power set, you know. So I'm excited to see what they thought of it.
Yeah.
Have your nieces seen
it? No, and I guess, well, I can't show it to the younger niece because she's 6 years old, and you know, World War One is a lot to take in. Already this easygoing version of World War One.
Yeah. It was a pretty easygoing version
of World War One. Because it was World War II transferred to World War One with the role of the US delegated to the Brits. At least I felt like that. If they would have said it in World War II, it would have been much better. Because that's also transitional. The movie is about transitioning, and World War One was a transitioning phase because first of all, it was a lot of technological advancements were made in World War One.
The car, it's about industrialization of war, yeah. Right?
And how are they called? Kings and queens were declared not obsolete, but they lost a lot of power after World War One. The Tsar in Russia was killed by his people after World War One. Austria lost a lot of its empire. Afterwards, the Germans didn't. Nobody went out being a winner of that experience. Yeah, it's a very
no. World War One was just, which is why I was excited for Ares's role and how they were going to play that out, because World War One was pretty much just a war of it was a very wasteful war,
yeah.
You know, for everybody involved.
Yeah.
And that was a really great scene as well, where Wonder Woman tells the generals in London, like, is this how you hide here in London?
Yeah.
In my, you know, where I come from, generals are on the field with their soldiers. Like, you should not have any respect. And I thought, you know, that was great. And again, it's her, like, learning about how the world works and pointing that out. But yeah, I mean, overall, World War One was just wasteful. So, you know, I think to have shown that wastefulness in the context of Ares being a dark, evil figure whispering in people's ears, which they kind of showed, but they didn't take it far enough.
Yeah.
Because, and I think it's a movie, right? So you need to be able to wrap up the story rather quickly.
Of course.
Because even after you've stopped Ares whispering in everyone's ear, if that was the way he influenced the war, you still need to make sure. Well, it's then going to be a longer time, not just the 3 seconds that they had between Ares dying and everyone hugging each other.
Yeah.
So that, you know, then they would have, but they were kind of, the deadline they had was the armistice. And so they could have played a little bit more with making sure that the armistice doesn't not get signed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Instead, they just kind of had the hug out. Whereas I think if they'd managed to just focus on getting the armistice signed, then that would have done it. I think, you know, because then you just need to communicate down the line to all the different troops and all the different places that the armistice is signed and we are no longer at war.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway, but, you know, those things aside, I think overall what Wonder Woman represented and I think the way the movie was put together, I really enjoyed it. I can't wait to watch it again. Like I've only seen it once, but I definitely want to go back and have a second viewing. Yeah, I really enjoyed
it. Okay. I'd leave a scene.
Awesome. So.
Oh, sorry. I'd leave the cinema after Steve crashes.
The Themyscira scenes were beautiful. Yeah. I really enjoyed those.
And it would have been great. No, forget it. A man can dream.
Go on.
But no, it would have been great if Steve would have crashed with the whole crew, because the enter-crew from the German boat, I always wondered where the boat from the landing crew went.
They had a naval frigate or something,
and
right?
It would have been
just kind of disappeared. they did just conveniently forget about the frigate. Like they just
and I thought that the beginning of the movie was like a siege on Themyscira by the Germans.
Yeah. Well, I would have really, you know, I would have loved for them to show me that the Amazons and Themyscira weren't just fighting with medieval weapons, so it wasn't just arrows and swords. But they also had some mythological weapons as well. So, I mean, they were up against firearms, right? Yeah. And there was that naval frigate on the coastline. So I would have loved for, they take down all the soldiers effectively on the beach, but then they can use a energy cannon of some divine description to take down the frigate. Like I thought, because it just keeps on coming, or it keeps on sending out more boats. Anyway, they conveniently forgot. Maybe they're like, we're going to spend our special effects budget somewhere else, so we're not going to put that together. But just on that, you know, I think if you look at that fight on the beach with the Amazons versus the soldiers, that was done pretty well.
Yeah.
Robin Wright as Antiope was just really cool. Yes. I thought she was awesome.
Especially that twinkle in her eye when she watches young Diana perform some moves. And at this point in time, they already must have trained in secret. The way she looks at her, it's just when you see the training sequence, say, that's where the smug smile comes from. You're already training her behind your sister's back.
Yeah. And I think that was cool to see her as a, Diana was caught in between those two people. Yeah. Like, those were her two major influences, you know, the love and compassion from her mother's side and then the warrior from her auntie's side. Yeah. And she was like a combination of those two characters. It was pretty cool. No, I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's got its flaws, as every and most movies do.
Of course, but it's, it's a DC movie. It's not like we weren't sitting on hot coals about Wonder Woman, so that the sense of relief is even higher.
All right, so to wrap up, let's hear what our friends thought. Cue the tape.
What did I think about the movie? Oh my God, it surpassed my expectations. I was hooked every moment of it, and they managed to inject it with the right amount of humor, drama, comedy, adventure. It was just the perfect film. And I loved, you know, getting the backstory, the history, where she came from, where she ended up, and just the emotions, you know, when she leaves the island, all the things she sees, the kind of childlike, playful humor that she has, or the questioning and, you know, her self-righteousness and the fact that she's always learning about man, humanity, you know, what they've become, what they are. You know, I thought Chris Pine also did a really good job. I liked, there was one scene where, you know, he's making a decision about, you know, what he's going to do, and the facial twitches that he makes where he's like, this is a really bad idea, but I'm going to do it anyway. I thought that was great. So super well casted, super well directed, and super well executed. It was an awesome film. I give it 10 out of 10.
I thought it was quite good. Lived up to my expectations. I think they did a lot of things right in the movie and avoided a lot of the traps that many of these films fall into. Especially with the story they had to tell, there's a lot of different tropes that they can fall into. In particular, I really liked how they handled the kind of fish out of the water Diana's intro into the real world after leaving an island paradise. It would have been very easy for them to go the normal route where everything has to be explained to her, and they kind of emphasize like, oh, you're so silly for not knowing these basic things. And instead they used it as kind of a commentary from her viewing our world from fresh eyes and making a commentary on things. For example, when she's going to get proper clothes and she asks, you know, why do women need to hide their tummy? That seems silly. You know, I thought it was really well done that way. Lucy Davis as Etta, I think, really added a lot of comedy into here. I think she stole the show every time she was on screen. Fantastic character. And then I also really appreciated that the story was fairly straightforward, which allowed us to really enjoy the characters and get to know them. The twist at the end, I think they did it well in that I wasn't really expecting it, but when it did happen, you know, I wasn't all that surprised. So it was unexpected, but once it kind of happened, you're like, oh yeah, you know, that makes sense. From a movie plot perspective, that was done well.
I've now seen Wonder Woman, and I will say that my favorite thing about the film was the first third or so of the movie, where there was a lot of humor between Chris Pine's character and Wonder Woman, with her being so sheltered and having such a, you know, specific view of the world. And then, you know, seeing her try to come in and explore the real world, there was so much comedy with that. I also learned I was wrong before the film. This is not Marvel, but this is DC. I will say that I was a little confused with the main themes of the film, because it seemed overly simplistic that she would just kill Ares and then the war would end, because I thought that they were kind of hinting at one of the themes being, well, it's not that simple. People aren't just bad or good. Yet at the same time, she kills Ares and it seems to be black and white that ends the war and these evil German soldiers with gas masks on take the gas masks off, and there are these, you know, young, boyish-looking, innocent German soldiers. And so I thought some of the themes were a little contradicting in that way. Like, it shouldn't be so simple that you just kill Ares and then suddenly all of this evil stops. And I will say, especially towards the very end, I thought it went a little long. Like, they could have been a little bit tighter with some of the action and the activity in that final third of the film. I overall really enjoyed it. I liked that there was some humor in it. I thought it was a little long, 2.5 hours on top of about 30 minutes of previews is a lot to ask someone, especially someone like me who can get antsy to sit. But I would be curious in a modern day how Wonder Woman comes back, who her rivals or opponents are in modern day versus in the World War I era. And hopefully in subsequent DC films, we'll be able to see some more of her.
So what do I think about Wonder Woman? Well, I went in not really knowing too much, you know, knowing the story a bit and kind of knowing what she was and loosely what she stood for. But now watching this film, like, oh my God, I've fallen in love. She's amazing. And I think Gal has brought a lot into the character and me feeling that way. But, you know, I've left kind of thinking, you know, she's there to stay and protect mankind, and she's selfless, and she's just amazing, and she's beautiful, and she's kick-ass, and, you know, she just dominates. And I think she is, you know, possibly one of the best superheroes now. And, you know, I probably wouldn't have said that if this film didn't, you know, come out, because the way, you know, she was pictured and came across back in the old films and stuff was very much kind of like fluff pieces. And now she's a superhero in her own right, and she should be given that airtime, and there should be many more films as long as they're as good as this one. But oh my God, yeah, big fan.
So what do I think of Wonder Woman now, in general about the character? Not that much different. I always thought she was pretty cool. Not something that I would have followed necessarily in the past without this movie, but excited to see, you know, what they do with her in the future DCU films. And hopefully they learn a lot from this film and how well it's doing because of the choices they made, and what not to do from Batman vs. Superman. And really looking forward to Aquaman and the rest and see how that goes.
Overall, I really enjoyed the Wonder Woman character. I thought Gal Gadot did a nice job, especially with the comedy. Sometimes I think there's this idea that superheroes are so courageous and strong and powerful, and I forget that there's a lot of humor sprinkled into these films, and this one was really funny to me. For the character overall of Wonder Woman, I liked that she had a lot of this supernatural strength, being Zeus's daughter and, you know, growing up with the Amazon women. But then when she comes to London and she is helping to stop World War I, she also has these very real human strengths like courage and hard work and perseverance and compassion. So I liked that there was a mix between the supernatural and the more human strengths. I liked that she seemed to think, there was one scene in the trenches where they say, you know, this is no man's land. And I was just waiting for her to say, yes, this is a woman's land or something like that. Like, she kind of had this idea that she could do things that men couldn't. And that was fun to see. So really liked the character, and I would be curious to see how she pops up in other DC films and how she relates to Batman and Superman and the other DC characters.
All right, awesome. So, what else have we been seeing? So, somebody finally saw the Lego Batman.
Yeah. Movie. And I don't have very many positive things to say about it.
You didn't like it?
I liked it, but as with Wonder Woman, there is a point where you can leave the cinema, and that's when Bruce Wayne enters the party. I think everything's set then. The quality is amazing and the humor works. Don't get me wrong, but I don't know. I didn't like Dick Grayson and the other franchises that are introduced in the movie took me out of it. Especially you introduce the Justice League and then they don't show up in the finale. It was a bit off-putting, I think.
Yeah, that's because they didn't invite him to the party.
Yeah, but I don't know. It looks beautiful.
So, you know how we're talking before about needing a parody movie of these movies? That's effectively what this is. You
know? Yeah, but
it's Batman eating lobster by himself in his massive home theater.
That was amazing. Don't get me wrong. I like that part, but as soon as they introduced Dick Grayson and the Joker's plot to get into the Phantom Zone and stuff, I dug the humor. The humor was fine, but I think the story was just, like I said earlier, you know, we live in an age where everything, almost everything becomes a reality, and this feels like something that became a reality and on the way had to be, there were too many obligations promised or too many promises made, yeah, and they just had to make it somehow. But then it's a testament, as you said earlier, to how flexible the Batman character is, because Batman worked in that movie. As outrageous as his persona is in that iteration, it totally worked.
Yeah. No, I think it was pretty crazy, but that's what I wanted out of it. I wanted something lighthearted. I wanted something that would take the piss a little bit,
yeah,
of the characters and just how crazy. And the whole point of like the whole Lego franchise, I guess, is that the storylines are totally out there because it's kind of written as if a 7-year-old was playing, you know,
yeah,
with their Lego characters. And so
right,
when you, to me, when I view it in that kind of context, it's like, it takes me back to if I was 7 and I was putting the story together in my mind, I would do the same crazy ass thing.
Yeah, but the Lego movie already did that so well. And I think that the Lego Batman movie is like the appendix to this movie. It's nice to have one, but if it hurts, take it out.
Yeah. I can see what you're saying. Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I wasn't offended by it.
No, it's not like I'm offended by
it. It didn't hurt me. You know what I'm saying?
Perhaps I went seeing it with the wrong expectations because of the Lego movie, because that was, I really enjoyed that movie. You know, the ending message.
Yeah, the Lego movie had a lot of heart.
Yeah.
And the ending message was really, really good. Whereas this one kind of had a little bit of a theme about family, but they didn't hammer the point and they didn't really, it was just kind of there, but they didn't kind of like frame it and draw it out and make sure that, you know, they kind of delivered the knockout punch,
yeah,
with that message. Yeah, so we'll see. I mean, to me, the Lego movies are great to watch, which when I've got the kids around.
Yeah.
You know, the kids, as in like my niece and nephew. Yeah.
Instead of giving them sugar, give them the visual sugar.
It's kind of like visual sugar, yeah. And then staying on the Batman topic, so you've also watched a documentary about the origin of Batman and I guess the creation,
yep,
of Batman.
There's a right? documentary called Batman and Bill that's been produced by Hulu. And it chronicles, there's an author out there, Mark Nobleman, who wrote the book called A Builder Boy Wonder about Bill Finger's contribution to Batman, because without Bill Finger, Batman would wear a red leotard and not have a cape, but wings. Look it up. It's amazing to see what kind of a hack Bob Kane actually was. Yeah.
And there's a lot of controversy around this documentary.
Yes,
as well.
Because to give credit to Mark Nobleman, he did a lot of legwork to not only uncover Bill Finger's life, but also get Bill Finger credited or his contributions credited. So far in the second season of Gotham and Dawn of Justice, I think I saw his name in a Batman comic too, because so far, wow, in time we only saw the Batman created by Bob Kane line.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what this comes down to is whenever you watch a Batman movie or any of these sort of DC Batman or even Superman type things, you always get the the character credit at the end, right?
Yeah.
So Batman created by Bob Kane. And so what this is saying is that Bob Kane, it sounds like the documentary frames him as a bit of a hack, but he wasn't solely responsible for what Batman is and how Batman was created. But there were other people involved, so Bill Finger being one of them.
You know, it's the same story with Stan Lee and his creators, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, and on. And if you take it seriously, the credit in Batman's case should be based on an idea by Bob Kane, developed by Bill Finger.
Yeah.
Would sound fairer. And there's, you know, if you want, it's just one vignette, but there, Jim Steranko told his Bob Kane story on Twitter, that he got a casual slap from Bob Kane in passing, and slapped Bob Kane in return to how he would react to being treated this way from okay. a complete stranger. It's an amazing story. They just met at a convention, and Bob Kane gave him this "how are you doing" slap.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't do that to a total stranger. And Jim Steranko was flabbergasted and decided the next day to confront Bob Kane with the same level of treatment, and got nothing from him. If you look at the interviews with Bob Kane and how he negotiated, he doesn't seem... I mean, of course, the documentary, the theme of the documentary isn't to let Bob Kane appear in a better light. But if you compare all the stories... And for example, he did a Batman exhibition sometime afterwards with paintings of Batman that he made, and later revealed to have hired ghost painters, so to say, to make mm-hmm. those paintings for him, which is a common practice. But the way he associated himself with Batman doesn't paint him in a very sympathetic light.
To me, I think a large part of the controversy with this documentary is that it does take a side, right? Like, it's very much saying Bill Finger's the man and Bob Kane, to use your words, was a hack. And it frames the whole thing in that way. And I think there's a big trend currently, like, you know, if you watch the old style documentaries, they tended to be a little bit, and old style, I mean, I don't know, like going back maybe 20, 30 years, yeah. right? They tended to be a little bit objective. They would kind of show you both sides of things and then, to a point, just let the viewer decide. Whereas these days, I think with the trend of, especially what we see on contentious topics like this, where there's a lot of emotions involved potentially, people tend to take sides. So yeah. the filmmakers take sides, and they frame the narrative to say a certain thing or to be activist in some way.
Of course.
And that's part of the controversy here, is that people are effectively saying that Bill Finger did everything, Bob Kane did nothing, and they're effectively, it feels like a Kickstarter video to get Bill Finger reinstated as the creator of Batman, you know? The thing is, I mean... And I haven't seen the documentary, but does it actually talk to anyone who was actually involved? Because all of this happened. Like, Batman was created, what, like 75, 80 years ago now?
Ooh, I'm not sure.
Batman's, I mean, it was a lot, he's pretty old as a character, yeah. right? So is there anyone who's like a primary source of what actually happened in those times and how it all came together?
Yeah, you have Carmine Infantino and Bob Kane's biographer talking about okay. the stuff. And they're... You know, and Len Wein is in it, and Bill Finger's contribution were how should I put it? There were stories in the comics community, but mm-hmm. nobody spoke out loud about them.
I was going to say, well, I mean, did Bill Finger himself has he been fighting this whole time to get himself to get his due?
Bill Finger had a lot of problems with just staying alive, so to say, and it's in Steranko's History of Comics that Bill Finger wasn't the fastest drawer in yeah. his capacity as an artist. So pretty early on, the work on Batman had been relegated to other artists, and he kind of fell out of the loop, and he had a divorce, and his son actually fought for his father's name to be reinstated in the credits. And the documentary follows also the part that Mark Nobleman uncovers that there is a granddaughter out there, which the granddaughter and her stepsister managed to get Bill Finger reinstated or credited, his work credited.
More correct. Yeah.
And you know, I'm with you on the part that it fails in being objectively presented, but then there's so much evidence that there isn't any. I mean, nobody knows how Bob Kane was as a private person, but in handling Batman, he didn't show he was not his best behavior, because Simon and Kirby shared the credits for Captain America, and it worked out.
Yeah, and I mean,
even Stan Lee gave his artists some credit.
Yeah. And it all comes down to, you know, at the end of the day, the personalities involved, the people, and just how they reacted and performed at the time. What is weird to me about this whole situation was that it's people after the fact making a decision to say that Bill Finger should get the credit. A lot of times in life, this is me. I'm gonna. What do you call it? Like, I don't know what a word is. I don't know, whatever. But, you know, there's the thing, like, it's a saying in Hollywood, you make the best deal you can at the time.
Of course.
When Steven Spielberg first started out, he couldn't be signing million-dollar deals because he'd only made one movie, right? And so he had to make the deal that he had to make at that time, do that work based on that contract, and then he can negotiate a better contract later on.
Of course.
And I think if you look at, you know, just what you were saying about Bill Finger, like, he had a lot going on with his life. He wasn't the fastest drawer.
Artist.
Bob Kane, on the other hand, I mean, fastest drawer?
Yeah, I just...
No. I thought you meant drawer in terms of, like, a gunslinger.
Oh, okay.
Like, shooting first. I thought it was about, like, how quick you are to draw your gun. Like, that's why I said it again. Whereas Bob Kane came across as he feels a lot more ruthless, right?
Yeah.
And so he really orchestrated. I mean, again, I don't know, because I don't have any primary evidence, or, you know, I don't really know the story that well. But he's the one that put his name on everything. So he's the one who effectively wrote the definitive credit of who Batman was created by. And so it's a little bit like, at this point, I think it's good to know the story, but I think it's more important that we get the lesson out of it, is that if you're going to be involved in creative endeavors, that you make sure that you get your dues at the time the best you can, because otherwise people are going to be arguing about it posthumously. And it's kind of like, it's not just, you know, in like art and not just in comics, it happens everywhere, right? So you see, like, I think even calculus in maths, right, was invented twice around the same time.
Yeah.
But we only credit Isaac Newton with it because he published first. So history is effectively written by the people who have the boldness to stake their claim on it sometimes. And the same, it sounds like this story here. You know, there's reasons why Bill Finger didn't get the credit that he deserves. And it's partly because, you know, because of the situation at the time.
Yeah.
Whereas now, and with documentaries like this, like, I haven't seen it, so I'm not judging it from what it is specifically. I'm just judging the approach, is that there's now a fanatical base of people potentially who are being activist about this. That's not good either.
No,
I mean, you know, it's good to raise awareness, but it's more about, I think, to my point, learn from it and make sure that, make sure you don't repeat the same mistakes.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's just my take. I mean, it'll be cool to watch the documentary, but if it's,
completely with you on that, but it's just, I guess, you know, it affected me emotionally, because at work I try to give credit where credit is due, and if somebody associates a good idea or a good endeavor with me and I had nothing to do with it except stand beside it or just make a remark that got the ball going, I try my best to communicate that, to say, hey, I didn't do the heavy lifting or anything like that. I just said a sentence and you got there all by yourself, or this person got there all by himself. So perhaps I'm extra sensitive to such cases. And I guess it's the same with the vocal mob that could get mobilized by this documentary.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'd like to watch it just to sort of see what the story is, but interesting. Interesting. Just make sure that if you do deserve credit, you stake your claim to it. And if other people did something, give them the credit as well.
Yeah.
That's my take. So, move on to our final review, maybe. This is going to be a quick one, because I don't have too much to say about the movie Blom on Netflix. It's an anime made by the same team that did The Knights of Cydonia. So if you like The Knights of Cydonia series, and especially the animation style that they have in there, definitely check this out. It's really cool. I watched it last night in its full glory of 4K and HDR, and I really thought it was fantastic. It's great to watch an anime that actually ends, because normally there's like seasons and seasons of stuff and the story never finishes. So it's great to see it's great to see something that's like it's just a once-off movie. And I think it was really good. Some really interesting concepts, some really great animation, and a lot of fun. So
is it called Blame?
It's called, it's spelt Blame! Exclamation mark. So Blame!
Yeah, because I thought it would make a great, how's it called? A great transition from the Bill Finger documentary to Blame.
Blame. Yeah. Blame Bill. Yeah. Blame Bob. So it's spelled Blame, but in the trailer, they pronounce it Blom.
Okay.
In the Japanese version of the movie, I didn't hear them really say Blom a whole lot, so I don't know. I don't know what it means, but maybe it's meaningless. But anyway, it was great. I mean, just from an animation point of view, I really enjoyed it. The story was pretty good, too. The action was really good. So,
what's it about in a nutshell?
That's a great question.
Okay.
It is set in a world where everybody, it's kind of like a post-apocalyptic reality, right? So it's like us humans have created we've automated the city.
Okay.
So effectively the way the city works is that effectively it is a self-replicating machine and we just live inside it, but the city obeys us. There are things known as builders that build stuff for us based on what we want and how we need the city to work. And then there are things as safeguards which help sort of keep order in some ways. So these little robotic police force kind of thing. What ends up happening in the context of this city is that the city stops responding to humans' commands because everybody had a techno gene or something like that, which gave us the ability to control and give commands to the city so we could manage it. But people started losing that gene because of some contagion, some sort of virus that spread, and we kind of lost that. And so the city started replicating in a disordered way.
Okay.
And because humans lost the gene, the police force, the safeguards, started to see humans as unauthorized inhabitants of the city. And so it started to hunt humans down. So humans now live in these little pockets which are hidden from the safeguards. And it follows the story of a couple of characters from one village who are running out of food, and they're trying to work out what can we do about the situation. And so they have to go out through the city to find more food. In doing so, they come across a lone traveler who seems to know how to correct the whole situation.
Of course.
And this is all generations. This is generations down the line. So the people in the village don't remember, or they've got mythologies about how humans at one point controlled the cities and were able to give the builders commands. But they don't remember what that reality looked like, because now they just live within the confines of the city.
That sounds interesting. Intriguing.
It's really cool. The action sequences and stuff are really cool. The animation is fantastic. Like, they do stuff with animation here that I was like, I would love to see some movies redone in this style. And even like, you know, these great epic sci-fi TV shows. So I thought The Expanse at the time, where while the sci-fi TV show is good, it doesn't go to the scale of what the books talk about, because they're doing it effectively on a TV budget, right? Doing it in animation, you can just imagine the visuals and the scale of how they can do some of these things. Like, it's just, I was really impressed. The animation style and what they were able to do was really great. It actually says, on the trailer, it says, it was thought it would be impossible to animate this. Yeah, you know, here it is. Or something. Like, it was, and I mean, to a point, I'm like, yeah, but I don't see why it was impossible. But maybe it's because I've not read the original manga. But what they are able to achieve with the animation here, and the like, even in HDR on a big 4K screen, it looked really cool. So
cool.
Definitely recommend
okay.
it. Cool, and that takes care of our movie reviews for this episode. So we had a couple of last things. Toys. So do you have any new toys?
Yeah.
Or is
the Lego company informed me that they have sets for the new Thor Ragnarok movie out in the shops. And
the sets?
Yeah, two sets. And being the obsessive compulsive toy collector that I am, I went out and bought them both, and they're amazing. They're way overpriced, but they're amazing.
So what are they? Like, what are these sets? Like, which...
There's the arena in which Thor meets Hulk for the first time.
Yeah.
And you have... There's a guard, a Hulk minifigure, a Grandmaster minifigure, and a Loki. And the whole set is very colorful. It has some great, wow. great functions. There are these huge lightning beams that Hulk can knock over. Yeah. And there are some weapons, and you have Thor in his new getup. With a shoulder cape, where the cape only drapes over one shoulder. It looks great. It has these neon red and blue cubes, which make it really pop. And you get a Gladiator Hulk minifigure with an axe and a club.
Right. Awesome. So we definitely have to put some pictures of these in the show notes.
they look amazing. And the second set consists of Hela, Fenris, the mythological Nordic wolf, two monster soldiers, the spaceship from the trailer, the circular spaceship, and a Valkyrie and a Thor minifigure. And it's colorful as well, because the spaceship is yellow and red, so it really pops. Valkyrie has this neon blue costume.
Yeah.
And a, how's it called when you only have hair in the middle of your head?
Mohawk.
A mohawk, thank you. and a mohawk and a shoulder cape. I really dig the shoulder capes on the figures.
Yeah, it's like shoulder capes are...
Yeah, they're neat. And Hela looks amazing. I only wanted the second set for the Hela minifigure because she comes with the full helmet.
Yeah.
With the full getup. It looks...
Looks
amazing. Those are...
Awesome. I'm going to have to go Google this.
Yeah, they're great sets.
So do you actually... Did you buy any of them yet, or it's just on the wish list?
I got them both. I had to go to the Lego store anyway, and I got an email from Lego that the sets are out. So I thought...
And you're like, okay, thanks, yoink.
You know, I got a summer bonus pay.
That's cool. So. Well, that's the pictures we should put up then. So have you created them? Have you built them up?
Yeah, Susie, I've built them up. I have two pictures already out on my Instagram. I can post them to the show's Instagram.
Oh, I didn't see those. We'll definitely post it to the show's Instagram. I didn't see your posts. Yeah,
I'll take some more because I have a large backlog of toys that I need to take photos of.
Yeah, you got some really good toy photos.
Oh, thank you.
You got the one anime character. Is it from One Piece? I can't remember. Guy with a big smile, and you can change the facial expressions.
The small dude.
Yeah,
that's from Future Boy Conan, the Miyazaki thing. Or a Ghibli.
Oh, right. Okay.
That's an amazing figure. I love that figure.
Yeah. The stories that you put together with that figure is really cool. Really fantastic. Because you had him hanging off like various things at one point.
Yeah. And Batman saves him.
Yeah. That's the one. Yeah. Those are really cool. I really enjoyed
Thank you.
Those are great photos.
And he meets Bruce Lee at one point.
Yeah. I know. He looked really worried. No, it's cool. Awesome. So yeah, that's cool. So definitely we'll put the Lego Thor Ragnarok picks up.
Yeah.
I look forward to seeing those. And then just before we wrap up, we've got one recommendation to push through.
One of the greatest podcasts I've ever listened to, except our show, of course.
Good save. Good save.
Podcast La Vista, baby. A podcast about the legacy that is Arnold Schwarzenegger's movies. It's an amazing review show. I've listened to the Predator episode, and the way those guys look at Predator made me appreciate the movie on a whole other level.
So they actually go back and they review all of the Arnold Schwarzenegger movies?
Not in the chronological order, and I haven't found out the order yet, but it's a good hit and miss ratio so far. They bring out like an episode a month, so one doesn't have to stress himself. And, you know, I've always, but that's the Austrian way, I've never taken Arnold Schwarzenegger very seriously until he became the governor of California, I think.
Oh, right. Yeah.
The podcast offered me a new way to look at his work and his acting, which is strange. Yeah. And I appreciate him much, much more. And he really is the treasure that people make him up to be. Such an amazing show.
All right. I'm going to have to definitely check that out then. And I mean, the pronunciation for Schwarzenegger. So how do you say it? I mean, you've said it twice already, but I want you to...
Schwarzenegger.
What's...
Schwarzenegger would be Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Okay, cool. There you go. That's the official Austrian pronunciation of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I don't know if it's the official.
Official. I'm making it official. Awesome. Well, that pretty much wraps up episode 5 of season 2 for Asteroids in Exile. Thank you so much for listening if you've come this far.
Thank you so much. We've already passed the 3-hour mark again.
Yeah. And we will catch you next time, so stay tuned.
I don't know very much about Wonder Woman, except that she is a super sexy female hero who doesn't wear very many clothes. I don't know what heroic acts she's performed, or why she's a hero, or where she came from, but I'm excited to see the movie to find out all about that.
Could get rid of the broom.
The broom. The brooms was holding them back.
It's not Ares that caused the war, it was the brooms.
I love it was the brooms.
I just put broom. I did nothing, Diana. I just put brooms up their asses. You monster.
That would have been a very different ending to the movie.
Would have been amazing.
the mass removal of the brooms, you know?
Gliding through the masses like in a fight scene, moving brooms. Yeah.
It's almost something that would come out of like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, you know. Like...
And Nicolas Cage could sell that, you know. He has the built-in insanity to sell something like that.
Einmal auf eine alte Frau kauft drüben, eine alte Frau kauft Speck, eine alte Frau schneidet sich den Finger weg. Was weiß ich? Ich hab den Reim voll vergessen. Na, so eine Scheiße ist das.